numbers in here. Let's see. I can probably field maybe one more question before we get started. Just off the cuff, anything. I've taught high school apologetics 6 years. I got a PhD in philosophy of religion, and I'm really passionate about apologetics. But I've debated guys like Matt Dillahunty and Dave Smalley on the problem of evil and does God exist. And my leading topic that I've been dealing with lately is abortion. I think we have an open and shut case at a rational level regarding abortion. At a rational level. At an emotional level, that's the hard work. That's where you're sifting through the knotted spaghetti of human complexities there. And that's where it tends to get difficult. But I can probably field one more question before we get started. Yes?
What is your opinion on the situation in the Middle East?
Opinion on the situation in the Middle East? Yes, it is a situation. I expect the enemies of the chosen people to be at their throats till the very last day on earth that there is an earth. I expect that conflict. I think the hostility that the Jews have faced is actually fulfilled prophecy. It's predicted anti-Semitism that you can trace through prophecies in the Old Testament. I think there is a sense in which the church replaces Israel, but there's another sense in which Israel is still the chosen people that have a special place in times. That's not my phone. That would be really embarrassing. Okay. Speaking of which, yeah. You can use flash photography all you want, by the way. Just don't let your phones ring out too much. Just get this side. That's my good side. Question, comment? All right. Welcome to this talk called The Two False Theodicy and the Problem of Animal Suffering. As I was saying, my name's John Ferrer. We've got a little seat, sitting room if you want to try to squeeze in. We might be able to fit. We got one chair here, one chair there. And we could probably fit one or two people in the aisles here. And then if you're okay sitting in front of the tables, you can fit there. But my name's John Ferrer, and I did my MDiv in apologetics here at Southern Evangelical Seminary, then went off to Southwestern Seminary and got a THM and PhD in philosophy of religion. And I'm really passionate about apologetics. My brother's an atheist, and I didn't quite have the leisure of that bubble Christianity where you can kind of assume everybody's a believer, because I knew one of the people living, sharing a bedroom with me was not. And he wasn't like ultra intellectual, but he would ask curious questions that you're not supposed to ask in Sunday school. And if you can't go to Sunday school or church for answers, you go elsewhere for answers, right? And so I think a lot of thoughtful, intelligent, intellectual people go elsewhere for answers because the church doesn't necessarily know how to create a safe place for thinkers to just be thinkers, to ask those tough questions, to probe, to understand. And a great deal of apologetics is trying to dignify that aspect of the Christian faith, because it's not all that popular. It doesn't market that well. It doesn't show up on baptismal records. This person learned yesterday. No, you can measure baptisms. The learning is a lot harder. Well, the two false theodicy flows from some of my passion about the problem of evil. If I say problem of evil, who has kind of a working sense of what that means before I get going into it? Okay, more than half, but I'll say it anyway. The problem of evil says basically, how can there be a good God when there's so much evil in the world? Is it coming on? Oh, might work if there's a receiver. Okay. So how can there be a good God when there's so much evil in the world? Or when there is evil in the world? Are you coming up? Come on. Let's try this again. So this is largely answered, or the general effort in answering this is to point out redemptive goods, some kinds of goods that are contingent on this kind of evil or this kind of suffering. So, for example, redemptive goods can justify the existence of certain evils like punishment. No one asks, why do bad things happen to bad people? That's why do bad things happen to good people? But at least some of these can be mitigated or softened or resolved by saying punishment is not an intrinsically offensive kind of suffering. And then abuses of free will. Anybody who's had a two-year-old in the house understands free will is not magnetically pulled to the good. And then character-building adversity. Some kinds of virtues, some kinds of goods that we develop within our person imply a context of loss, need, deprivation, sorrow, suffering. So forgiveness, grace, mercy, courage, hope. These imply contexts that aren't Pollyanna and everything's A-okay. But those are still goods, and I think it's within God's interest to try to generate these kinds of goods that don't fit with his character, because he's a perfect being and has no contingency. I don't want to go into too much about that, because I want to go to a variant on the problem of evil that talks about gratuitous suffering. Gratuitous, if you've watched a movie that has gratuitous violence, that's extra bang bang, shoot 'em up, lots of blood, you know, buckets of blood for no good reason. That's gratuitous violence. Well, gratuitous suffering is suffering that is needless. It exceeds any redemptive good that could be drawn from it. Animal suffering is a key example of this. The chief formulator of this version of the problem of evil is a guy named William Rowe. This problem of evil version is called the evidential argument from evil, and the core of it is gratuitous suffering. And his chief example is what he calls Bambi. It's a forest fire scenario. Imagine you had a forest fire that somehow donuts around this suffering. That donuts around this poor deer. And a deer dies miles and miles away from any human that could benefit indirectly from any of this. And it's a slow burning death. That's kind of hard to explain with some of our conventional, what's called theodicies, or defenses of God's goodness in light of evil. So the problem of animal suffering poses an acute challenge to the Christian faith. In particular, how can there be a good God if animals suffer needlessly and pointlessly? Let that sink in for a bit. How can there be a good God if animals suffer needlessly or pointlessly? Now, I want you to appreciate the problem first before we go into answer mode. Because when you have someone asking you, how can there be a good God when this evil happens? Or how can God let my grandmother die? Or how can, I just came from the vet and I'm not sure that my dog's going to make it through the night. How can there be a good God? Now, we can go into answer mode there, but as we're talking about what is apologetics, it's not just information, it's also skill. And part of the skill and part of the heart of apologetics, I think, is answering the questioner more than the question. So when a person asks this kind of question, understand this is emotionally loaded. This is weighted with a whole backstory to it that if you rush into answer mode, you might totally shoot past it and do more harm than good. It's kind of like if my wife asks, do I look fat in this? She's not asking for an objective assessment from an outsider. She's asking a question that has a whole backstory to it. All kinds of self-consciousness, beliefs about her body. That's a loaded question. I have to answer that like I'm performing surgery here. She's actually pretty good about this. But you get my point. When someone asks about the problem of evil, in particular something with emotional laden circumstances in it, take some time, maybe 5 seconds, pause and let me think about that. To absorb the full weight of it. And you might want to ask some probing questions with the person. Why do you ask? Is this something that's been bothering you for a while? Can you think of an example that really troubles you? Maybe I can respond to a particular example that's in your head. But let the full force of it sink in and then dignify the nature of the problem. Before you answer it, dignify the question. When you dignify the question, you're saying it's good to think. It's good to be a thoughtful person. Now, I'm going to rush past a lot of that right here, doing exactly opposite of what I just advised you for the sake of time here. Because you didn't come here to have me, you know, well, anyway, you came here for data, I'm sure. So how do we explain any animal suffering before Adam and Eve? Yeah, I just went there. This is a big dividing point between many young Earth creationists and old Earth creationists. I'm going to give a largely old Earth creation account, that is, assuming that there's a long time frame, and that animals... what time do we get out of here?
2:30, I think.
2:30, okay. And that animals that seem to have died and or suffered before Adam and Eve, some of that really happened. I'm going to assume that. Now, if you don't hold that view, then the value for this, if you're of a young Earth persuasion, the value for this is to say, well, what if? Next time someone grills you on that, instead of arguing for young Earth, explicitly say, what if it were old Earth? If what this guy says is true, if this two false theodicy holds together, then you still aren't justified in denying God's existence, regardless of how old you think the Earth is. Okay? So you can use it as a hypothetical if this isn't what you think is the actual case. So there's some preliminary responses to the problem of animal suffering. The first one, and this is our go-to option usually, the Adamic fall, the fall of mankind, Adam and Eve. They are federal representatives for humanity in an important sense. It's kind of like when the king falls, the kingdom stumbles with him. If dad's a drunk, the whole family feels the repercussions of that. You've got a representative role. That's not all bad, but it's not all good either. If he does great good, then the family is rewarded for it. If you had ancestors who did a great job setting up a legacy for you, then you may still be reaping the benefits from generations ago. Well, that's corporate benefit, corporate privilege. There's also corporate guilt when the representative of your company or your family or your country is making an embarrassment of things. I'm not naming any names. Classic defenses also come up here. Some of these might play into the problem of animal suffering. Classic defenses are the free will defense. And I'm gonna go loosely back and forth between the word defense and theodicy. I'm not going to draw, if you know what Plantinga says about it, he makes a big deal about the difference here. I'm just using them kind of interchangeably, so don't be too offended by that. Also, soul making, or character building as it's called. Punishment. And then another one is inscrutability. Inscrutable means you can't search it. You can't search it out. It's like a question, you don't know how to phrase it so that Google will understand. That's inscrutable. inscrutability defense says the kind of being in question in the problem of evil is precisely the kind of being we would expect to have ways we cannot understand. If God is all-knowing, all-powerful, all-good, why on earth would we expect to be able to understand all that? I can walk into a math or physics classroom and be totally blown away by what I'm seeing, having no comprehension of what they're saying. And that's human intelligence. How much more so if you magnify that times God's infinity, God's perfect knowledge? I have every reason to expect to be surprised. Now, the inscrutability defense is not an appeal to ignorance. It does not say, we don't know, therefore God must have a reason we don't know. We don't know only proves that we don't know. Ignorance is only proof of ignorance. However, the inscrutability defense argues from knowledge about God. It says, if you want to raise a question about an all-good, all-knowing, all-powerful God, then you have to frame this problem with respect to that kind of being. And that's the kind of being who would have ways that we can't fully search out. That's the inscrutability defense. I think it's a very powerful defense. But don't say, because we don't know, therefore there must be reasons God has. That's not the basis for our conclusion. God's nature is the basis for our conclusion, not our ignorance. Does that help? Not if yes. Scratch your beard if no. Okay. Also, mitigating physiology and behaviors. Now, mitigating means to soften or diminish. Not all animals feel pain. So the problem of animal suffering can be lessened a bit when we recognize that sponges aren't really hurting down there. The temperature might change a little bit, and they're okay. They might even die, and there's no pain that happened there, no suffering. So many animals don't feel any pain sensations. Usually this problem of animal suffering is towards higher order animals, closer to like pets or, you know, dolphins or elephants, things that seem to have the neural capacity to where they might actually have something going on up here. And they don't just have pain responses, but they can discern it. They can understand it. And they have a feeling internally that corresponds with it. And that would be the suffering problem. Not all animals suffer when experiencing pain. If you've ever been a devious little kid, you might have, you know, plucked the legs off a spider or something, or burned little ants or something with the magnifying glass. That's pretty weird. That makes me sound bad. I didn't really do that, but I knew people who did that, and that's probably not a good sign. But those animals probably do not have the neural capacity for any kind of robust experience that corresponds to their pain. Now, do they squirm and try to avoid that? Yes. They might have the equivalent of pain response internally, but there's not a mind that says, this is terrible. I feel bad. It's more like a reaction, like when you touch a hot stove and you pull back. Before you feel anything, before it reaches your brain and you've got a conscious awareness of what just happened, you can pull back because you've got your neural synapse is just kind of bypass your central nervous system. It doesn't reach your spinal cord or your brain. It just responds quicker than that. A lot of your animals have the equivalent of that. They can respond with the equivalent of a pain response without having suffering going on. Suffering's a mental thing. Pain is a physical thing. I'll stop. Some animals have shock sleep response that could potentially reduce pain. My wife and I had a pet rabbit named Petunia. She named the pet. If I had named the pet would have been like Krull or Grok or something. Not even manly, when you can grunt when you're saying. But she named our pet Petunia. And Petunia had this cute little feature where when you pet her, she liked to have you stroke her whole head. But if you stroked her right along here, right from the nose up across the forehead, you do that a couple times and she will be hypnotized. She'll go passive. Now you can tell by her breathing patterns and how long it takes her to move when you stop. If you just pet her, as soon as you stop, she'll start moving around trying to get you to pet her some more. But if you do the little hypnosis stroke, she will pause and not move for like 30 seconds until she kind of arouses again and says, oh yeah, what just happened? Where am I? You can do this with chickens. You can do this with crocodiles. I think there's lots of different animals that have this. But I would suggest this might be a feature that can mitigate pain response in suffering. They might have the pain response at a neurological level, but they don't have the mental capacity to feel suffering. And so you don't have the problem of animals suffering if they don't have the mental capacity because it's turned off at the time, even if they might have pain response and can feel harm. Also, some predatory animal attacks kill in a quick and painless way, such as going straight for the jugular. That's quicker than, you know, a bunch of pinpricks or something. Or they inject a toxin that for its kind of predator, it will be dead within a minute, as opposed to, you know, hours and days of torturous suffering. There's also the response of biodiversity. Predatory behavior and natural death can serve certain ecological goods. Where, for example, dead animals eventually become fertilizer. You could have maybe whale carcasses that serve like a biosphere underwater. There's a wide array of different strange and unusual benefits. I'm not enough of a scientist to elaborate this kind of stuff. You can ask my wife. She's got a science degree from Clemson. This is also a variation of the natural law defense. The natural law defense says things like tectonic plate shifts and weather patterns, the water cycle. These are still good. They create a regular, reliable world that has law-like behaviors to it that we can interact with and grow and develop and become fully orbed human beings because we don't have to turn at every corner wondering if maybe gravity is going to stop working now. Or maybe a surprise east wind's going to come in and knock me off my feet, but it's only localized to me because that's how this world works. No, we've got law-like behavior that makes this universe and this world orderly enough to where we can operate in it, and that's really good. Well, biodiversity is kind of like that. You can go outside right now and find interrelation of species that makes grass possible, that makes the trees possible. Even when it comes to predation, predatory animals prey on other animals that eat vegetation. If you take out the predators because you don't want them to kill Bambi, well, then Bambi keeps eating the grass. And because the grass is getting pulled up, you've got water erosion, which causes the brink of the island to recede, which damages the trees, which limits the environment for all tree-dwelling animals because we took out the predators. But if you have the predators, they can reduce the population of deer, which means you can have better grass, you can have better trees, you can have a more robust biosphere or biodiversity. Plus, animal death is recycling, and recycling's good, right? Now, none of these are considered, I don't consider any of these to be Grand Slam, win the World Series, all in one shot type of deals. I think each of these are base hits. You put them together and you've got a winning game. Also, there are foreshadowed traits. Animal traits which may have anticipated the fall. Was God surprised when Satan tempted Adam and Eve?
No.
So God knew it was coming, right? Now, if God, according to historic, normal Christian teaching, is the one who created the animals, would it not make sense for him to create them in a way that's going to be fit for what's going to happen down the road? That's consistent. It's a little conjectural, but it's consistent. There's also redirected traits, so physical features that could be used for different things. Predators may have the ability to move fast and to rip and tear, but that would help them get to a recently deceased antelope before another one could. And so they could reach a already dead animal and treat it like carrion instead of hunting and killing, which could incur suffering. And so it's possible that traits that they had from the beginning could be used in a way that doesn't entail as much animal suffering. And after the fall, it entails more animal suffering. There's also adaptive behavior, not just physical features, but behaviors that can adapt to whatever food source is in the environment. And then animal free will. This is an interesting one. I used to not favor this that much, but then I had pets. I don't want to push this one too hard because I don't know that I'm prepared to defend it at a rigorous level. But if you've had pets, you might have a sense of when they seem to express moral guilt. They know they did what they weren't supposed to. It's probably not on par with what we think of as moral guilt. But there's a shame response. There's the appearance of guilt with some animals. The higher level they are intellectually, the better case you can make that they have such free will that they could be morally responsible for some things. And this creates a really interesting prospect. What if animals have their own respective fall before God? Some are more fallen and some are less fallen. C.S. Lewis entertains this in fiction in the Narnia series, how some of the animals reflect the fall more than others. Others are still talking and have not fallen, whereas some become more brutish and beastly, and that's kind of the outworking of their fallenness. Now, that's fiction. I don't want to push this too hard, but I think animal free will helps explain a lot of things. There's also animal souls and saint making or character development relative to animals. This is an argument that Trent Doherty brings out in The Problem of Animal Pain. Very fascinating stuff. Again, I don't want to play this card too hard because I don't know that he gives a really strong argument. It's more like a what if kind of story, but it's possible. And I believe John Ortberg in his book Heaven argues that there will be animals in heaven. following, and not just created up there, but ones that are saved in a sense. They're rescued from the fallen world into heaven. Interesting thesis, but this is consistent with it. And then there may be some misleading appearances. This is a real strong one among young earth creationists. It looks like there was death and suffering among the animals before the fall, but maybe it wasn't. Maybe it wasn't before the fall. The time frame, time reference is off. And so you can place it on Adam and Eve. It was their fault. It was after the human fall. But some of it might not be as overt and obvious as it seems. Then there's the Imago Dei theodicy. I'm really glad Kyle just came in. Did you bring snacks? Because the late person has to bring snacks. Okay. So the Imago Dei theodicy, which I've been toying about with a long time, and Kyle helped develop it some more this morning, talking about how the Garden of Eden is in many ways akin to a temple. It's a holy place that was supposed to be where Adam and Eve cultivated, cared for the garden, but it was both conquest and it was worship, like that of priest kings. And so they were supposed to take the Garden of Eden, that idea of a place, that real place, and spread it out. Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Well, the Garden of Eden wasn't over the whole earth. It was over a location. How are they to fill the earth and stay in the garden? They have to spread the garden. Well, that's perfectly consistent with the commissioning of Adam and Eve, which in some sense is still true of all of us. He made us in His image. The words image and likeness are very fascinating word study. For the sake of time, I can't go into it too much, but there does seem to be some implications that there's rulership involved. Not just authority, but responsibility. We have power over nature, over creation. Anyone who has a pet knows this. You are a lord over that pet. And you can do it well or you can do it poorly, but you have to answer to God either way. We have that kind of influence over the rest of nature too. And I would suggest so does Satan. And hence we have the two falls theodicy. Theodicy means a defense of God in light of evil, or the justification of God. The two falls theodicy goes something like this. Given a biblical Christian worldview, nothing harebrained here, no weird aberrant heresy. I'm just dealing with down the line normal historic Christian teaching. The reality and consequences of sin, including animal suffering, which is potentially a consequence of sin, the reality and consequences of sin are traceable not just to one fall, but two. This isn't mind-blowing stuff. This is stuff that if you've been reading your Bible, if you've been going to Sunday school, if you've been going to church much in your life, then this is pretty mundane stuff. Yet it's groundbreaking for a lot of the discussion on the problem of evil, because I think the problem of evil as a line of argument has been taken over by philosophers of religion who are not defending Christianity, but an abstract sense of theism. And as a result, they've got this tool belt of all kinds of explanatory tools that they won't touch, because they're busy trying to make the conventional free will theodicy cover everything. Or they're busy trying to make inscrutability defense cover everything. Or they're busy trying to make the natural law theodicy cover everything. And I say it's all of the above. We got explanatory resources that can really empower us regarding what's probably the biggest central objection in Christianity. The central objection against Christianity is the problem of evil. And animal suffering is as good a version as any. But we've got an angelic fall. Now, how does it work? It's customary to attribute most or all of the fallenness of the world to Adamic sin in the Garden of Eden. It's customary to do that. I've listened to dozens of problem of evil debates. I've read many dozens of books on the problem of evil. And they overwhelmingly say it's all Adam's fault. Some will say it's Eve's fault. The smarter ones say it's both. But they don't go before that. Well, hold on a second. Did Adam and Eve need any help to sin in the garden? They might have found a way to do it without Satan, but they had some help. That old serpent, as Satan's referred to in Revelation 12:9, I believe, is probably what's going on in Genesis 3, the temptation in the garden. How do you have the old serpent, Satan, present in the garden, tempting, knowing better and still tempting? If there was no sin going on anywhere, how do you have him sinning? Unless sin predated Adam and Eve. Now, I'm not saying that by itself is sufficient proof, but that's a crack. That's a little crack in the levee. And I think when you push this crack and then you start to do a biblical theology of Satan and the angelic fall, you start to realize that this whole levee breaks. Adam and Eve are responsible for a great deal of the wrong that came after them, and we're reaping the consequences of it. I think it's just. I affirm their federal representation of all of us. They're kind of like a mother and father of all humanity, and when dad is a drunk, then everybody suffers. When mom and dad screw things up, we all feel it. So there's a rightfulness about it. There's nothing unjust there. But the more we try to put on their shoulders and say it was all their fault, the less persuasive that defense becomes. Because we're saying it's all their fault. They did all of it. Everything. Hurricanes. Holocaust. It's all their fault. It becomes less and less persuasive. Now, if we've got angelic forces, and we know from, I think it was one angel of death that killed like 100,000 Assyrian soldiers at one point. I forget the reference. If one angel can do that, and Satan is like one of the head angels, then we're dealing with a force of nature in that he's a created being. We're dealing with a force of nature that is way more powerful than any human being is. And that helps explain why the earth manifests the design of a designer God who could create all this and leave hints of heaven around all of it, yet it's still fallen at every corner. Every part of creation is touched by sin. Every part of you is affected by sin. Your ability to have faith is not pure and holy while your intellect is prideful. No, it's all touched by sin. So, the two falls offer more explanatory room for animal suffering, for natural evil, and the extent of corruption in the world. In short, two falls means less reason to grant the existence of pointless suffering and the evidential form of the problem of evil, a la a guy named William Rowe. Now, if pointless evil exists, here's how we might apply it into a version of the problem of evil. If pointless evil exists, then there does not exist an all-good, all-knowing, all-powerful God. If pointless evil exists, then a God who is not surprised by anything, a God who does not have accidents, we would not expect gratuitous evil if that kind of a God exists. Angelic and human free will suggests that, for all we know, there might not be any pointless evil, because there was a free agent, and free will is good. There's a free agent behind it. This gives us a lot of explanatory power. And so the conclusion is that the problem of evil is inconclusive at the end. God may or may not exist. If this is what we're working with, the problem of evil with regard to the animal suffering issue, it's inconclusive. Obviously, the big challenge here is the second premise. How do we prove that angelic and human free will suggest that there might not be any pointless evil? That's the challenge point. I'm okay with that. I embrace that burden of proof. Well, there are some problems within the problem of evil. I'll rush through this. Actually, I'll skip it for the sake of time. I'll make key points about my slide available on my website. I do not have it up yet. But if you give me about 24 hours, I should be able to have it up. IntelligentChristianFaith.com. And my personal email, don't abuse it. Don't sell it to anybody. I don't want any spam here. JohnFerrera42@yahoo.com. So if we don't get to cover all that I want to cover, I'll make it available there. Or if you have a follow-up question or some private personal something you're not comfortable asking in class, then reach me there. The leading explanations for the pre-Adamic suffering and death in the animal kingdom are this. It doesn't matter. They're just animals. Who cares? Some people kind of favor this if they're a little heartless, little rough. This was kind of the norm in, among a lot of the church fathers, a lot of archaic views, where it was tough living. It was tough living. You lived closer. Like, if you ate meat, that's because you butchered meat. So you're kind of closer to it. You might not have as much modern sensitivities here. But this is kind of before the days of animal rights. And even now, even meat eaters, we recognize there's better and worse ways to slaughter a calf. You can do it in a painless way or a way that extends the suffering. And we should not try to extend their suffering needlessly. So this, I don't think, is an overall effective answer. Another one is to say that it didn't happen much or it didn't happen at all. This is oftentimes popular with young earth creationists. I'm going to suspend this and say I'm granting, at least for the sake of argument, that the appearance of pre-fall and pre-Adamic fall animal suffering is real. That actually happened. I'm just going to grant that and move on so that we can get to the rest of it. But there's some evidences that could be used to this effect, that there are some mitigating factors where it didn't seem to happen as much or at all. Another practice is to punt on first down. I don't want to get too caught up trying to explain the game of football, but punting on first down is too early. You want to use your downs, your plays. That's what football is it's plays. And instead of using your four downs, you punt on the first one. You surrender too quickly. You start waving the red flag as soon as someone raises a stiff objection. I would say we don't need to do this. And it makes it look like God is patching over our ignorance with faith, using faith as an excuse to stay ignorant. I don't think that's God glorifying. I don't think we should punt to blind faith. I don't think we should punt to ignorance. And I don't think we should punt to inscrutability and say, oh, who knows? Therefore, God must have a reason. That doesn't logically follow. And then there's the retroactive Adamic fall. This is probably the leading academic response to this issue. It says that Adam and Eve are still the culprits, but when they sinned, the effects of their sin went backward too, backward and forward. So animals and creation felt the force of their fall before Adam and Eve were even born. Now, philosophically, it's really hard to defeat this objection or defeat this defense. But at the same time, there's something really counterintuitive about it. It sounds very strange. It's very weird. I don't find it very compelling myself. I think it's academically respectable. It deserves a response. But I consider it to be conjectural rather than evidential. We're not working from normal Christian teaching. This is really just guesswork. It's rationally coherent, but I don't think it's necessary that we appeal to something as conjectural and counterintuitive as that, when we've got all these other tools in our Christian tool belt that we haven't even taken out and used yet. Why make up stuff? And I'm not saying it's necessarily false, but why jump to conjecture when we can still appeal to the satanic fall? Now, there's benefits to the two false theodicy. One, it admits that animal suffering matters. Animal suffering matters. As apologists, dignify the emotional aspect. Don't just rush past and say, here's my answer. Say, why? It sounds like you're suffering. What's troubling you? Before I go into answer mode, let me know where you're coming from. What's going on in your life? When we do that, we're dignifying the pain, and that puts us in a better position to do some worldview surgery. But no one wants someone with this sword of the spirit like some scalpel, and people are coming at them like this. That's not how to do apologetics. And that's not how to minister to people. But if they know that you're not a thief or a mugger or some thug with a knife, and they know you are a surgeon doing worldview surgery, once they trust you, they might then start to let you come near and offer some persuasive answers. But we need to earn that. And so admitting animal suffering is one of the ways that we show not only does God have heart, so do I. And now they're willing to listen to me about what I have to say about God. Also, it admits pre-fall animal suffering. The chief verse that's used against this is Romans 5:12, where it says, through Adam, death seemed to enter the world. I tend to think that means death to man, because Romans 1 through 10 is all about human salvation. It's not strictly about animals. They might be implied therein, but I don't want to assume that unless it's pretty clear in context. But it admits pre-fall animal suffering, which makes this much more palatable to skeptics and critics who aren't generally as impressed by young earth creationism. It fits classical theism. I'm a big fan of the God of Augustine, Anselm, Aquinas, and I would say Paul and Jesus. But there are some variations that are philosophically attractive, like deism. Molinism is very popular. I won't explain it. Don't ask me to. It's too long. Neotheism, or what's called divine personalism, is also very popular. And then open theism. I put open and process theism here, not because they're the same thing, but they overlap a little bit. Open theists hate being called process theists. It drives them up the wall. I just put them together because I was running out of space. Okay. But I don't think we need to make the concessions that these alternative theisms have. What I'm proposing fits with them, but it doesn't require these alternatives. It fits with historic Christianity just fine. And it fits with classical theism just fine. Also, it doesn't punt on first down, which we know the problem with that. It's less conjectural and more intuitive than Dembski's retroactive fall theory. So I think it offers an advantage over the fall. It expands on the strongest, most popular defense / theodicy, which is the free will defense. Philosophers love the free will defense. Alvin Plantinga made an early philosophical dent in the world using a version of the free will defense. Richard Swinburne loves it. I hear it in Eleanor Stump, Marilyn McCord Adams, Peter Vandenwagen. I mean, pretty much all of your main philosophers who've responded to the problem of evil, they're using a variation of the free will defense. And if we're using a variation on it that applies free will to angels too, then you're still staying within your strong suit. That's an advantage. It aligns well with Scripture, which we'll show in a second. It aligns well with historic Christian teaching, which we'll also show. And it shows internal coherence of Christian thought. The problem of evil is not just a challenge to an abstract God of the philosophers. It's a consistency check for religion. It asks this religion, are you consistent with yourself? If we were not adhering to a particular religion, the problem of evil is easy to answer. How can there be a good God when there's so much evil in the world? Well, maybe he's handicapped. He couldn't stop it. Maybe he's only kind of good. He's just good on the weekends. And then he's a real jerk during the weekdays. If you're not committed to a particular faith system, then the problem of evil isn't a problem. But the problem of evil is nonetheless one of the most popular, one of the stiffest objections, because underneath the abstract philosophical argumentation, there tends to be these religious adherents who say, my God can still be true even when there's evil in the world. And my God is a particular kind of God, not just some abstract, generic something. And so I think this is a really great way for Christians to respond. And potentially, I don't know how well this holds, but Jews probably could too. Muslims, a lot of your ones that could fit with classical theism could do this. It'd probably be a little harder with Buddhism or Hinduism or Jainism or something like that. Also, it merges insights from some leading thinkers. For the sake of time, I'm just going to rush through this, but Alvin Plantinga, he proposes that perhaps there are angelic beings with free will that are pulling some of the strings, making craziness happen out there. Greg Boyd does the single best development of the two falls theodicy, but he calls it the warfare theodicy. He's an open theist, and he thinks God doesn't know the future. So he unpacks it in a very different way, and I think because of that association, a lot of the philosophers of a more traditional Christian sense, have left this alone. Most people aren't commenting on this, and I'm picking it up because I don't want the devil to get all the good music, you know? I don't want the devil to get all the good ideas. I don't want bad ideas or heretics to be able to steal all the attention away from good ideas. There's a really good idea here that's very biblical, and that it's that Satan is behind a lot of the evil in the world. Greg Boyd didn't invent that concept. The Bible first elaborated that. Also, Richard Swinburne proposes that maybe animals have some measure of free will. Very interesting prospect there. This idea I'm proposing aligns with some of that. Now, why we've seen some benefits of it, but that doesn't necessarily make it true. Why should we believe that it's true? Well, I think it rightly recognizes a real religious theological context to the problem of evil. That's what Poe means, problem of evil, if you can see it there. The problem of evil is easy to solve if you aren't committed to any faith tradition. But this is consistent with historic Christianity. And for those of us that claim Christianity, it's important to know what tools do we have in our tool belt. Do these tools help explain what's going on? Yes, they do. Are they native to Christianity? Yes, they are. Do they fit well together? They sure do. Therefore, this is a winsome explanation. The angelic fall is biblical, historic Christian teaching. Angels and demons appear to have free will. If they can morally rebel, that means they're moral beings, and if they're moral, that implies volition, free will. And if they have free will, then they have moral responsibility before a holy God. Now, their context is a little different from ours, right? They're in God's presence. When they screw up, they don't get a chance to repent. Well, what's the point? I mean, the full evidence of God is right there in front of them. And if they still disbelieve, then God's like, oh, there's no hope for you. Bye-bye. And so they don't get a chance to repent. I believe this is elaborated in Hebrews 12 as well, if you want biblical backing for it. The Garden of Eden was set apart within the rest of the earth. Notice, Adam and Eve were not placed in the utopia that is the whole globe. They were placed in the Garden of Eden, which was a subset within the world. Why do you have to set apart the Garden of Eden? If the world is perfect and unfallen, why does he have to have a set apart place? Well, they were commissioned to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. That makes sense if they were supposed to start in the Garden of Eden and manifest God's image to the world through rightful responsibility, cultivating and caring for it, and making his glory known through the way they represent him to the world. And spread out that the temple context, the sanctifying influence, the worship going on there, the cultivation, the caring, even the conquest. And how could there be other forces at work that are threatening the garden, that are threatening what they're doing? Well, according to John 12:31, the earth is Satan's. Now, I'm not saying he's sovereign in the most ultimate sense. God is still sovereign in the most ultimate sense. But Satan still has a lot of permission from God to do what Satan's going to do. He still answers to God for how he acts. And he's going to be judged for acting fool. You know what I'm saying?
That
yes.
Sounds a bit like Manichaeanism. Like natural world versus the divine. The natural world is governed by the evil God. And
I can see how it would sound that way, but I'm only going as far as Scripture says there. John 12:31 says this. I'm not saying there's comparable forces. I say God is way beyond in power and authority, and Manichaeists say that there's a dualism where they're kind of equal in power. You've got a good polarity and a bad polarity, and they're always at war with each other. I say there's no war. But it's more like a kid pitching a temper tantrum till dad gets home. Yeah. Yeah, you're not talking equal forces here. You're talking someone who's supposed to act good but is rebelling against that. And when dad finally comes home and lets them tire out, then he's going to, you know, do what dad's going to do when kid needs a whooping. Okay. So Satan, that old serpent, was sinning before Adam fell, according to Revelation 12:9 and compared with Genesis 3. But perhaps this happened even before Genesis 1:1. I'm not making that case, but this has been suggested and argued Clay Jones in his book, Why Does God Allow Evil? Great book. Fairly new. I strongly recommend it to anybody interested in the problem of evil. This, I think, has the single best response to the problem of evil overall. And it's also one of the shorter books on the subject. So Satan was already sinning before Adam and Eve did anything wrong. And Scripture teaches that demons can and do tamper with the natural order. How much time we have? Anybody?
Just 10 minutes.
10 minutes? Okay. I think I can probably wrap it up pretty quick. Okay. And then we'll have some time for questions. It fits with the biblical names for Satan. Satan is called the God of this age or God of this world, same depending on how you translate it. Prince of the power of the air. That's a pretty vaulted status. His name Satan means adversary. He's the devil, enemy, tempter, wicked, deceiver, Lucifer, which means shining one, or it also translates as morning star. He's compared to a wolf or a roaring lion, a great dragon, serpent of old, Beelzebub, which means lord of the flies, or some translations interpret that as lord of dung, or the dung god. Ruler of this world. The dung god's in charge. Legion. Now, God's higher, right? God's a greater authority. And we have a measure of authority, too. We're kind of competing. We're enemies of the enemy here. And we've been given authority and the Holy Spirit to work in us. So it's not a strict Manichaean sense, but there's a real power that Satan has. Demons are called legion when there's a bunch of them. And then Abaddon, the destroying angel. Now, his biblical descriptions, his job descriptions are that he fell from heaven. He tempted Adam and Eve. He steals, kills, and destroys. He harasses. He tempts. He binds people with ailments. He's got power of disease. Satan has helpers. He rules over the demons. He has a kingdom. He's filled with violence. He possesses man and animal. Remember the pigs that go off the cliff? The first thing those demons did once they got to be in pigs is they killed them. Mm-hmm. Animal death. He blinds and darkens people's understanding. He roams around the earth in Job 2. Eleanor Stump makes an interesting observation. When Satan has this counsel with God, God says, what have you been doing? I think God knows, but he wants Satan to admit what he's doing. He says he's roaming back and forth around the earth. How does he have authority to do that? He's off limits, right? No. This is his domain. Now, there's a sense in which it's his domain, a higher sense in which it's God's. But he has a measure of authority that he's permitted. And apparently he was trying to mess with Job, but Job has a hedge around him. God's been protecting him. And he goes to God, the Father, or maybe the triune God, I don't know. But he goes to God asking permission to mess with Job. He has to ask permission to mess with Job. We do not know that he had to ask permission to mess with anybody else at the time. But at least with Job, he had to ask permission. And God lets him do what he can do. And what can he do? He can cause diseases. He can kill the flocks. He can incite bandits to go steal stuff. He can kill his kids, create storms. If this guy was at work before Adam and Eve sinned, well, we've got plenty of reason to expect those kinds of things to go on before Adam and Eve were doing their thing. So he possesses man and animal. He blinds and darkens. The world is his. He will be defeated. He's also called a guardian cherub, an angel of light, a schemer. He's even able to inspire false religions. Ever think about that? I teach world religions, and one of the challenges is why are there these other religions when Christianity is the true one, according to what you're saying, teach? Well, because there's more forces at work than the truth. There's liars out there that are wanting to deceive people into saying, oh, all paths will get you there. Everybody's going to heaven. It's all good. We know that we are from God and the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. 1 John 5:19, Luke 4:5-6. And the devil took Jesus up and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time and said to him, to you, I will give all this authority and their glory, for it has been delivered to me, and I give it to whom I will. If you then will worship me, it will all be yours. Now, we have no reason to think that he's going to make true on his bet, even if Jesus took him up on it. Jesus doesn't. He doesn't give in to the temptation. And he's a liar, Satan is. But Jesus does not contest with him this. He doesn't say, you don't have that authority. Perhaps he does. I'm making that real firm, but this is consistent with what I've been saying. Now, there's a couple drawbacks, and this will be it. Now, to skeptics and critics, this may sound kind of ad hoc, like a Just So story. But I'm not pulling this stuff out of thin air. I'm pulling from my Christian tool belt. I'm pulling from within the resources of historic Christianity. If a person wants to phrase the problem of evil as a consistency check, here, I'm just being consistent. Nothing wrong with that. Some may say it's circular. You're using invisible beings to explain invisible beings. I get it. I get what you're saying. But no, it's more like we do the same thing in math. You've never, I guarantee none of you has stubbed your toe on some four. Have you ever smelled some five? No, these aren't empirical objects. They're immaterial things. Yet we can use four and five in mathematical proofs for other invisible things too. Just because it's not empirical doesn't mean anything of great substance here. It just means that it's not empirical. So if we're talking about things that fit within normal historic Christianity, we can show that we're being consistent. And we can have other independent reasons for believing in God. First cause argument, design argument, moral argument, resurrection, fulfilled prophecies, miracles. We can have plenty of reasons to believe in God, and now we're just showing that the problem of evil doesn't disprove it. Theological inferences do not equal blind guesses. We're arguing from what Christianity has already allowed. We're not just making up stuff. Now, it does complicate things, contrary to the favored principle, Occam's razor. But Occam's razor is a general principle. He says, don't multiply causes unnecessarily. That's a good idea. Generally, don't multiply causes unnecessarily. But you should explain things as simply as you can and no simpler. If you explain a thing simpler than it is, then you are doing it injustice. And suffering is a complicated thing. We should not try to explain it in simpler terms than suit the thing we're trying to explain. It adds no complexity to Christian thought. We've already affirmed the fall of Satan and that he messes with things. That's kind of his job description. And having that before Adam and Eve is not a big stretch, since we already know he was tempting before Adam and Eve sinned. Also, suffering is complicated, and atheism, the big problem with atheism, or one of them, there's many, is that it's a barren landscape. It's empty in there. And the only interesting thing in atheism is stuff smuggled in from theism. Morality, meaning, purpose in life, value. These aren't material relations. These are sophisticated, transcendent kinds of things that make sense if there's a mind behind all of this. But if there's only blind, unthinking processes, then all of these things that really give life and human experience meaningfulness and value, all of these things are kind of hollow. There's potentially some entangling alliances here, though, because this was first or best introduced by a guy named Greg Boyd, who was an open theist. This, however, doesn't require you to be an open theist. Word faith movement might talk about Satan in grandiose terms where you need to directly combat Satan with your words and fight direct spiritual warfare like that. Some charismatic chaos goes off the deep end that way too. But none of that is required if you're going to affirm the two false theodicy. All right. I'll stop there. Whew. I'm going to try to publish on this, so don't go trying to outscoop me on this, please. But feel free to appeal to Angelic Fall to help explain things. But I'll try to make a version of this available on my website, and you can also email me with any questions or further comments. Okay, questions? Yes?
Just to clarify, is your URL Intelligent Faith or Intelligent Christian Faith?
It's Intelligent Christian Faith. It used to be Intelligent Faith, and then I let it lapse and someone bought it from me. So you might need to take that picture again back there. Okay, question.
Yeah, I have a question. Did I misunderstand or misread it, or mishear? All three could be possible with me.
Me too.
Where you said the animals were had a soul.
I tend to think some animals.
When the scripture tells us that he breathed life and doesn't make us a living soul. And when Adam and Eve sinned, God covered them with skins of animals. So did he kill them innocently, a living soul, with no redemptive process?
Very, very interesting line of questioning. I tend to think that at least some animals have a soul because the biblical term for many of them is nephesh, which is literally soul. Their lives are many times referred to in the Old Testament and New Testament with... That's kind of a colloquial term in Hebrew to refer to a living entity as a soul, a nephesh. And so I'm willing to take them on face value and believe that there's some sense of soul.
Mind, will, and emotions.
Oh, you're talking about personhood. I'm not granting full personhood. I'm just granting some sense of soul.
People, yeah. We're different than the animals. We're spirit beings. We live forever. We're spirit beings like the angels. We have that spirit dimension. We worship God. The animals don't. But I think the scientific term for...
I think bird songs are worshiping God. Whether they're conscious of it or not is a different question.
Is it a soulish animal like a dog exhibits mind, will, and emotion?
I'm willing to entertain the possibility. I'm not married to that. I'm willing to entertain that possibility. But we are distinct from the animals.
Right.
There's no biblical record of God breathing life directly into them. There's a sense in which we have this imago Dei, a commissioning from God, and we have
in His image where we write.
Correct. Yes. I would not want to undermine that. That's very biblical. Yes.
You're thinking that the retroactive endemic fall of causality might be weak. Is that still yet possibly related to the foreshadowing traits that you mentioned earlier?
Let me think.
Repeat the question.
Okay, the question is Dembski's, and you're free to go. We should probably open the door so people know they can come in. The question is, does the retroactive fall that Bill Dembski elaborated somehow map onto this idea of foreshadowed traits where maybe some animals, before any fall, had like sharp teeth and claws or something? Haven't thought about that. I'll have to think about it. I don't see any strict conflict between them, but I don't think they entail each other either. I think the hand was up back there, and then up here, and that'll be it.
Just to find that great void in the God at War and Satan's problem of evil acknowledges that that his idea of cosmic warfare is compatible with classic theism. In other words, he doesn't use it like a case for open.
Yeah, I was real impressed with that book. I really liked his writing. I don't agree with his open theism, but his conviction about trying to stay true to Scripture, I dig that. And he could probably teach a lot of Christian theologians a thing or two when it comes to reverence for Scripture. I just think his philosophy is a little weak when he concedes too much. Because he thinks God is in time in some sense, and he doesn't know the future. I think God is outside of time, and that's the only way to reconcile the whole picture of Scripture. But that's a good point. Thank you. Yes?
Sure.
You. What's your name?
Carmen.
Yeah.
When you were talking before about the animals and the climate problem, that sort of thing, if you put that on the shelf just for a minute, are you saying at all that suffering happens to animals is objectively evil, that it's always evil absent of our putting our human understanding on it to say, and we're talking about animals before, and they seem to appear to...
I would say gratuitous suffering is evil. Does that... Well, gosh, I need to...
She would be able to interpret it.
Yeah, so the distinction I think you're making is that between perceived as evil versus it's factually an evil. It's just wrong, regardless of what you feel about it or think about it. So that would be objective evil. I would say at least some of it would count as objective evil. I'm not prepared to explain exactly how we know that objectively, because you got two problems of objective morality. One is objective knowledge of a moral fact, and then the other is the moral fact. What makes it a fact that X is wrong? I think we can grant at least on a provisional level that some evils are real evils, and when it happens to an animal, it's still evil. Our knowledge about that might be a little harder to verify. But I'm okay with saying we... If someone walks up to your pet, you got a little poodle, and they just like kick that thing for a field goal. That's not funny. That's barbaric. It made me laugh too. if they like field goal kick your pet dog, that's evil. Mm-hmm. Anybody here think that's who knows? I don't know. Maybe it's evil. Maybe it's good. That's wrong. You shouldn't do that. Now, can God use that in a way that redeems it for greater good? Well, sure. You have free will. Free will defense might play into that. And if you did that, then you answer to God for the evil that you did. And so there's a bigger framework to help resolve the problem, but we can still recognize that as evil.
Yeah. I have another question because free will keeps coming up. And I've always taught that there's no will that's free. Will is always influenced by something, either by God or Satan. And thus, the choices we make have an outward influence on us. We're either believers in God, or Jesus said, you are of your father, the devil. We're either influenced by something, so thus will is not actually free.
I affirm a version of free will, but it's not as strong as what most people would call libertarian free will. But it's not as weak as what most people would call compatibilism. I would say that if you affirm a strict version of libertarian free will, then not even God is free. Can God surprise himself? Can God do something that he didn't know he was going to do?
No.
Therefore, God, in the way some people define determinism, God is deterministic himself too. But I don't think you've explained away his free will there, because it's not just whether you have the power to deviate relative to time. It's about whether you're the cause of your actions. And I think God is the cause of his actions, hence God's free.
We're free moral agents, but thus our will is still...
The influence is a factor. At least some of our choices, I think, we are responsible for, and we are the sufficient cause for them. And in that sense, we have free will. Relative to time, we have the power of contrary choice. Right. Relative to eternity, we can only do what God knows we're doing.
Right.
We have no ability to do other than what we do. Can anybody do other than what they do? You can only do what you do. Now, do you have the potential to have done otherwise? Sure. But what you actually do is all you can do. If you follow what I'm saying. From eternity, it's all established facts. And so that's all determined in a sense. But as long as you're the cause of your actions, then you're free. And in that sense, God can be free, we can be free, and potentially even animals could be free. At least in some sense. We should probably spread out. Thank you.